This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you from Chicago, USA. With your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. You know, many people come up with a ton of ideas for business all the time, but what does it take to get that idea off the ground? Professor of Management at New York Institute of Technology, Joanne Shillitoe, is going to explain how to properly go about turning that idea into a real business. Thanks for joining me, Joanne.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So I have a cousin, and he loves to come up with ideas for new types of businesses. And one of the things he wanted to do was to make candles. He actually, that's one of his biggest hobbies, is that he makes candles and makes molds for candles. But the problem he always had was trying to figure out how to get people to buy his product. Do you sit there and have the investor already, or do you have the products on hand and then try to sell them?
Well, you know, investors are really interested in big growth businesses. So for a candle business where he wants to sell, you know, per the individual candle, does he really need, or he or she really need, that much initial investment to really get going? It sounds like this individual, your cousin, is able to make some already. So until they get to the point where they actually need to manufacture a lot and maybe would need some investors at that point, probably not. I would say they'd be looking at making the candles, see what they can sell, et cetera. You have to also remember that investors want to take a piece of the company. They want to get some percentage of ownership, and it's not always something that an entrepreneur wants to give away and get funding in response. So in turn, you know, you want to do it as much as possible without getting investors involved. I think it's usually a necessity to get investors involved when businesses are at a growth stage and they need that money to take it to the next place.
Not every idea is going to be profitable. I know in terms of my cousin, it's like every 6 months he has a new idea that's going to make him money. It usually doesn't pan out that way, but he believes it to his core, like, oh, this is going to be the one. How do you know when an idea is going to be profitable versus it's just a dream?
First of all, this is concept of entrepreneurial hubris. Most entrepreneurs believe whatever their idea is, that everybody else is going to love it and it's going to be profitable. So that's not unusual, actually. There's some tools that can be used. The Startup Scorecard has a wonderful tool. It's a feasibility analysis, and it brings you through 6 different sections based upon the product, the customers, the market, etc. And think about, and you give it a scorecard of an A through an F, and to get an idea of where the weaknesses are and whether this is profitable. But I mean, you clearly just have to look at how much does it cost to make each item and what is the selling price. I mean, you have to have a margin built in there too. So that's pretty clear as well. So there's some tools that you can use to think about whether it can be profitable. That doesn't mean that if it looks like it can be profitable in a feasibility analysis and you have a margin from what it costs to make to what you can sell it at, that it is going to be profitable in the end. There's a lot of things that can go wrong in the process, such as customer preferences might change. And so, you know, the product can no longer be something that's desired by customers, et cetera. So that's why there's always risk involved in entrepreneurship.
What if you just can't afford your idea? Like you really believe in it. You've done it on a very small scale, but you can't get over that cusp for whatever reason. Let's say you can't get a business loan. What do you do at that point?
I guess the question is there something in there that you can transfer to somebody else and still maintain ownership? Okay, if it's just an idea, usually that's not enough to get somebody else to take and run with it and then you maintain ownership. But if you can get some intellectual property rights, such as copyright for maybe software coding or a patent, then you've developed it sufficiently enough that maybe you can license it out to somebody else who's actually going to take it and commercialize it, and you'll get some royalties or some payback as part ownership of the business or at least of the patent. So there's ways to do it, but it just really depends on the idea and what you have. But usually transferring it over and getting what an entrepreneur, somebody who wants to take the commercialization involved, it has to be developed a little bit, whether there's a prototype, there's a patent, or you've got some initial sales in the building and the business has already started. So there's something that they can grasp and take and move with.
Now, I was told a long time ago that if you go looking for investors, that you need to have a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA, signed before you start talking. Is that true or is that a bit too far?
It depends on, once again, what you're talking about, what your product is all about. You know, there's this concept of competitive advantage. Firms, we teach this in strategy classes. What is it about the firm that really distinguishes it and is going to be the source of profitability in the firm, okay? If the source of the competitive advantage is the knowledge of the entrepreneur, then why do you need a non-disclosure agreement? Because nobody's going to be able to take that away from you. If it's a device that is a mechanical engineering device or something, yeah, you need an NDA before you get a patent, or at least a provisional patent. Once you have the provisional patent, then you don't need it once again. You don't want to create too many obstacles between you and investors, and I will tell you, it's very hard to get in front of good investors who are really interested in your idea, so you don't want to make it too difficult for them to engage. And you might also work within the trusted network. If you're a student or an alumni of the university with an entrepreneurship center, I would recommend going and talking with them. Usually they're working within what we call a trusted network. They have investors, business development people, that there's an understanding that they're not going to take advantage of the students and the alumni, and willing to give some honest feedback and maybe take a look and give some feedback that might lead it towards some investment. So there's lots of different ways to approach that. But a non-disclosure agreement is not always necessary, and you might come across as a little bit too guarded, and the investors might get turned off in the end. So it just depends on the idea and what you're dealing with and your business idea.
Now, you did say, like, you don't want it to be hard for investors. And I think to myself, I've never actually done something like this, inventing something, wanting to get it patented. I love Shark Tank. How realistic is that? You know, how realistic is it that I'm going to get, if I have a great idea, that I'm going to get in front of Mark Cuban? I mean, is it that easy?
No, it's not that easy. And in fact, they do a lot of preliminary shows or vetting out. They go through universities and stuff. And I've never known anybody who's actually gone on the show. And I know they'll go through many, many people. So if that's your goal, then it's probably going to be very difficult to do that. But there's a lot of universities and investing groups that will hold similar types of events where you get a chance to get in front of investors, but they're usually vetted out in advance. They're not open in the sense that you have to go through some process to even be considered. And the incubators and accelerators also do those same kinds of, they're called business plan or pitch competitions, where you get a chance to get in front of investors. Investors want to see the great ideas, so they're really happy to be part of those. But when it's run by an investing group or a university or an incubator accelerator, they also know that it's not going to be just anybody, but these are ideas that have been developed and that other people have deemed them ready to be considered for investing. And then still there's no guarantees you're going to get an investor. But to randomly be able to look for investors and just pitch your idea, that's really tough to do. So you really want to go through some development processes. You want to get involved, whether it's your university, talk to people at incubators, work some business development people, and try and get some feedback and development so you can actually prepare and get into the pipeline for those kinds of events.
Now, one of the things I think of, you know, you think of Shark Tank, and I think of other stories I've read, that it seems pretty easy to get in front of somebody, but I guess it's not. One of the things I wanted to talk about, and I'm not sure if you heard about it, there was an artist, Ray J. He started his own electric scooter company, I think back in late 2017. He showed, I got my own company. It's called Raycon. And then in early 2018, it came out that he stole the idea. Ray J went into a partnership with this other man, Paul something. I can't remember his last name. Sorry. But he technically stole the idea. Now, what could have Jean-Paul have done to protect himself from Ray J stealing his idea of an electric scooter? I mean, would he have done an NDA at that point? Or was 2 years too long to get the company up and Ray J had the right to take the idea and start his own company? I mean, which side is right?
Well, it depends on the partnership. That's a legal agreement. So they must have had a contract. Hopefully they had a contract engaged on ownership and intellectual property embedded within that. If things were not intellectually property protected, it's possible that one partner can take it and move with it. But you'd have to go back and look at that partnership. And partnerships are tough because these kinds of things can happen. You're dealing with personalities. You really want to work with somebody you have complementary skills, but also a good personal chemistry with, to get along with. I really am not familiar with that particular
particular case, but it really comes down to the partnership contract that they had. And was the firm based upon that scooter, and they formed the partnership based upon that scooter, what was missing that allowed that partner to take it and do something and on their own with that?
Yeah, I've read a lot of articles about this because it's just interesting, I think. And it didn't have too much information. And I'm hoping that by the end of the year, the whole thing will come out. But from the looks of it, it looks like John Paul wanted Ray J to not only be an investor, but an endorser of this electric scooter. And then not too long afterwards, Ray J formed his own company that was in direct competition to what they originally had. And it looks kind of weird, but then 2 years, he gave him 2 years in money and he was going to endorse it and nothing happened from it. So Ray J's like, well, I'm not going to let a good idea go away. I'm going to do it myself. And I would think I would do that too, because, money's on the table, right?
Yeah, and he also has deeper pockets. So he's able to do something individually, where the original idea, person with the idea was not able to do something. They needed investors and they needed the endorsement of somebody to really get this to take off. But it's very possible. I don't know much about the scooter itself, but is there really something unique in that was patented, or is it just a branded scooter with some unique colors and some unique designs, in which case anybody could have copied it anyhow? But having that endorsement was really the competitive advantage.
What could Jean-Paul have done? If he was already had this idea, he wanted the scooters, he knew it was a great idea, and obviously he's like, well, all I need is a celebrity endorsement and I can take it to the bank. What else could he have done to really expedite his product?
It would have been the contract. It would have had a good lawyer set up that contract and the agreement, and probably would include some sort of non-compete clause.
Let's hope he had that.
Who knows? But you know what? Even when somebody does violate your intellectual property, sometimes it comes down to how deep your pockets are. You hear these stories all the time about big companies might do that to small companies, and the small company is kind of defenseless because they don't have the money to actually challenge it in the court system. So there's a lot at play, but always talk to a good lawyer if you're getting into some sort of agreement with somebody like that, and make sure that you're protected by contract as a first step. Maybe they had a contract that was only valid for 2 years, and then there was nothing about non-compete. So in turn, maybe he was free to do it and nothing was happening with the firm. So he went ahead and did it.
I'm glad you talked about the deep pockets of the companies. It reminds me of this case. It was a while ago, I think a few years. EA, Electronic Arts, it's a gaming developer company. They stole an idea or the concept of a game from the smaller video game publisher. And they could never prove it. They could never take it to court. They could just say it's the same game, except they just changed the main character. But it's the same game. And they're like, there's nothing we can do about it because it's EA. It's a $1 million or $1 billion company. And we're just two guys. So when that happens, what do you do?
Once again, hopefully you had a contract that can be enforced. And if it's a clear case, you might be able to get that company to pay for your legal fees as well.
But it's really it doesn't look like you can do much. I mean, they'll keep you in court for years. I know they've done that, but Mattel has done that when it came to Barbie. They'll keep smaller companies in court for years, hoping you just go bankrupt and then they don't have to worry about it.
And maybe picking the right partner is the secret. Some big companies have these corporate venturing arms. Google has it. Panasonic has it. I would hope that because they're actually intentionally working with entrepreneurial firms, maybe they're a little bit better. So pick your partners wisely. That's part of the challenge. But deep pockets do prevail, unfortunately. And that's why the small companies are working with them, because they're limited in what they can do. But if you have an ironclad contract, there's less that they can do.
Okay, people, you heard it here first. Get a good lawyer. Get a good contract lawyer. Call it a day.
Always have an accountant and a lawyer in your pocket. Somebody who's looking out for you. Absolutely.
Well, Joanne, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. For those listening, where can they find more information about you?
I'm a professor at New York Institute of Technology. You can see my bio and profile on there and over at LinkedIn as well.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Head to WGNradio.com for exclusive content by Mason. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter @MasonVeraPayne, that's all one word, and don't forget to share the show with your friends.